Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, it is a story of one man who wished upon a star. Actually, a universe full of stars, and who, like the song sung by Jiminy Cricket or Cliff Edwards in Pinocchio, had his unlikely dream come true. It's a story of Frank Kovac Jr., a man who loves to look up at the night sky and who wanted to share the experience and his passion with the people of northern Wisconsin. It's a story of the creation of the Kovac Planetarium, which was built from scratch in the countryside in Little Monaco, a community off Highway 8 near Rhinelander, and which today attracts hundreds of visitors to its location on Mud Creek Road. Our guest today wrote a newly published book about Frank Kovac and his dream, a book published by Wisconsin History Society Press, titled The Man Who Painted the Universe, The Story of a Planetarium in the Heart of the North Woods. Ron Legro and Avi Lank joined us today from our Wisconsin Public Radio Milwaukee Bureau. And as always, you're welcome to join the conversation. Maybe you've been to the Kovac Planetarium. Maybe you have a love of the night sky, of astronomy, or science. You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, I will read it live on the air. Ron and Abby, thanks for being with us today. And let me run down your biography so the folks know who we're talking about. Ron Legro is a freelance writer, a former reporter, columnist, and editor for the Milwaukee Sentinel, and editor-in-chief of Wisconsin Reports, which is a weekly public affairs journal covering the state legislature. A political speechwriter, former director of telecommunications for the city of Milwaukee. He grew up in Antigo, and he lives in Whitefish Bay. Avi Lank is an essayist for Milwaukee Public Radio, a panelist on the Interchange Public Affairs Show on Milwaukee Public TV, an award-winning reporter, columnist, and editor at the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Journal Sentinel. He grew up in the Finger Lakes region of New York State and also lives in Whitefish Bay. So, guys, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
We did ask Frank Kovac if he wanted to be a part of the program, which is about his planetarium, but he says he's busy today with his day job at the paper mill, which I think says a lot about Frank Kovac.
Well, he does have a day job, and I think it interferes a little bit with his planetarium work, which is where he really wants to be, but he has to pay the bills, and he's a one-man show.
Well, that planetarium is open to visitors, but the website for it, which is kovacplanetarium.com, says it's closed for the season.
Right, and it was a year-round operation. It's a heated facility. The problem is that Frank is out of pocket. He's a sole proprietor, as Avi likes to say, that's S-O-U-L, sole proprietor.
Right, right.
But the problem is he's out of pocket and he's got cash flow issues and he's got debt from building this thing. And so he went back to full-time work at the paper mill where he started out up there. And so his hours are limited. You have to call ahead and make a reservation.
So what prompted you two veteran journalists from Whitefish Bay to write this book?
Well, Ron found out about the place through a friend who had a cabin up in that direction. And he went and saw it with his wife and came back just raving about it. And my wife and I made a special journey up there to take a look at it. And as soon as you meet Frank and as soon as you see this planetarium, you know it's something special. One thing I think the listeners ought to be aware of is that when you think about a planetarium, you might think of something like the Adler Planetarium in Chicago or the planetarium at UW in Wausau. where there's a fixed dome and there's a projector that comes up and it projects stars on the dome, and then that it moves those stars to show you what it wants to show you. That's like 99.9% of the planetariums in the world are like that. Frank's is different. Frank's is the world's largest rotating globe planetarium, which is exactly what it sounds like. He has built a 2.5-ton, 22-foot in diameter plywood, mostly plywood ball with a 45-degree angle sliced in it. You walk inside it and you sit, and on it he has painted the stars. He's painted more than 5,500 stars of what the night sky would look like above Monaco on a clear night. And then he's rigged it up to a motor so that it actually rotates around you. That in itself is rather extraordinary and rang all my bells as a journalist. And then when you get to know Frank, you can't resist him. He's an extremely nice, soft-spoken but not unduly modest fellow,
mm-hmm.
who thought this whole thing up out of his head. He didn't realize that actually there are three other rotating globe planetaria in the world. He didn't know about them when he was making this whole thing up, and he worked for a decade to build it.
So this is one of only four rotating dome planetariums in the world.
And by far the largest. The other three are – there's one at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago, which is – Frank grew up in Chicago, but the what they call the Atwood Sphere wasn't really operational when he was a kid. He never saw it. The other two are – one's in Russia in St. Petersburg, and the other one is in northern Germany near Kiel.
Has anybody else, a private citizen not linked to a foundation or a government or an astrophysics organization, ever tried to do something like this that you know
well,
of?
Well, sort of. We cover this in the book. Back in the 50s, 57, when Sputnik was launched by the Soviet Union, there was a big rush in the beginning of the space race and a big rush in America towards science education and especially anything astronomical. And so the government was letting out money for people to build planetariums wherever they could, in high schools, civic centers. People were buying kits and putting them up in their garages for a while. It was kind of a mania. However, all of that was, you know, pre-made, kit-made planetariums, usually fairly small. Frank's was not only handmade and built from scratch from spare parts and whatever he could scrounge at the lumber yards or the metalworking shops.
Or the paper mill.
But on top of that, it doesn't have a projector. The projectors cost upwards, if you want to get towards a semi-professional level or upwards, projectors that can paint the domes with starlight run up upwards of $150,000, $200,000. Frank didn't have that kind of money. So this was... he didn't have a choice. He had to come up with an alternative, and he drew on his childhood experiences. He had painted a star mural, if you will, on his bedroom wall as a child, and
that was growing up in Chicago, right, in Lincoln Park, and later the Belmont neighborhood.
Even when he was as early as age five, his dad got him a telescope when he was a little guy. From a pawn shop, and he just fell in love with the stars, and he became this sort of self-taught expert on astronomy and wanted to be an astronaut, wanted to be an astronomer. Didn't have the grades for it, but he just pursued it throughout his life, went to the libraries and read all the books, bought used books, went to the Adler as often as his parents would take him, and then got to the point where he was riding his bike across downtown Chicago streets alone so he could go to the Adler and take courses. And he realized pretty quickly that he wasn't going to have the academic ability to become a professional, but that didn't stop him.
Apparently he didn't have the math skills that would be needed to be an astrophysicist.
He certainly didn't believe he had the math skills. On the other hand, he did all the math and all the design to build this sphere and to put the stars in the proper places. If you ask him, he'll tell you he has shop math. But, you know, there's obviously a better understanding of mathematics inside him. But how it was asked to be done academically, that apparently didn't match his talents.
Well,
and abilities.
Well, how did Frank build it when he had no previous experience and he doesn't know anything about engineering?
Well, he worked in a fabrication
machine shop,
and he learned to do shop work. You know, it was sort of like industrial arts in high school carried on. So he could work with metal and wood, and he could do he did have shop math, you know, simple math, not complicated architectural level math. But he had a terrific visual imagination. And he could think of things in his head, and then later he could sketch them down, and he could build them. In fact, when it comes to – and the book covers all of this in some detail. When it came to painting the dome with the stars, he was forced to paint – because of the unusual luminescent paint he was using, he was forced to paint white on white, which is a little bit hard, you know, putting dots of paint in the proper position on a big, giant dome.
On a white background.
22 right. feet in diameter. But he had a star map to reference, but he also had his internal visual map in his head, and he could go out into the night sky, look up, and say, you know, that star I just painted, but Betelgeuse is just a little bit off. I'm going back and repainting that thing, you know, whatever it was. And so he clearly has a good visual retention. I don't think he could have done it without that. Plus, he's physically adept. He was, even as a child, he was really good at climbing, which required being up on ladders for long periods, almost always alone, so that at one point when the dome crashed around him, and luckily he miraculously escaped injury, he was able to rescue himself and not be crushed to death and laying there for hours.
Here's how your book starts, and I'm going to quote from it. On a near freezing March evening in 2001, Frank A. Kovac Jr.'s dream came crashing down around him, all 3,500 pounds of it. The dream was a hollow wooden globe 22 feet in diameter, and it had just become a deadly object.
Yep. And in fact, that was actually the second time what he had been trying to build collapsed. The first time it didn't collapse around him, but it collapsed nonetheless. And we go into that in the book, too.
Well, how close did he come to dying or having a serious injury in that second incident?
What you have to understand is, and I think we explain it in the book, the sphere was not complete. It was ribbed out. And I think to try and help people understand it, there's an old Buster Keaton movie where Buster's building a house, he's building a wall, and it falls down around him, but he's standing in the doorway where there's no door, so it falls down all around him. That's what happened here. There were enough holes in these segments that when it came down, it didn't harm him, miraculously.
Yeah, I've seen that Buster Keaton scene, and I've always marveled at the risk that he was taking to film that in one take. He had to be standing in the exact perfect spot for that whole building wall to fall down on him with the one part that was cut away right where he was standing.
The difference here, of course, is that Frank was doing this absolutely alone in the middle. I believe it was the winter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In the middle of the winter, off of Mud Creek Road, which is off of Route 8, you know, almost into the National Forest in the town of Monaco, Wisconsin. And he's lucky that he had some neighbors who were close enough that they heard what happened, that one of them came and found him, and then they went from there. One other set of skills Frank had that we haven't mentioned which actually are relevant to this particular incident we're talking about. Just prior to moving to Monaco, Frank had been in the Air Force for a couple of years, and he was stationed up at the old Sawyer base up in the Upper Peninsula. It's no longer there anymore.
It was called Siberia, according to your book, by some of the folks in the service.
Frank wanted to go there for a couple of reasons. One, it was close enough to Chicago that he could get down and see his family. But the other was that he knew he wanted to settle up in the North Woods because he could see the stars so well, and he liked it up there. But his job up there, it turns out, one of his jobs, was helping to load bombs into B-52 aircraft. And to do that, you have to learn all kinds of things about how you winch things and make sure they're balanced correctly when you're setting them up to work on it. And it turned out those skills were very important for when he went on with this adventure of building this big sphere.
These were nuclear bombs, right?
Yes, they certainly were.
Which leads to another point, Glenn, another quality that Frank brought to this project, which was his amazing persistence. We just marveled at how he spent about 10 years working on this nights and weekends, and how he had many setbacks. Things didn't work out. He was sort of seat of the pants. He would just go from point A to point B. And when he couldn't get to point B because of some problem, engineering or otherwise, he would just come up with another plan and work around the problem. It struck us that after a year or two of these, one setback after another, where things didn't work, right up until the end when he wasn't sure his motor system would actually turn this dome, and it didn't the first time he tried it.
Right.
And, any one of those points, especially the crashes, an ordinary person would just say, to hell with this. I'm going to go, take up soccer or something. But he just kept going because it was his dream. And we kind of distinguish him in this book. There are other people like that throughout history who single-handedly almost created something just out of their sheer force of will and their drive and desire.
And if you just joined us, dear listeners, we are talking to Ron Legro and Avi Lank. They are the authors of a new book published by Wisconsin History Society Press called The Man Who Painted the Universe, the story of a planetarium in the heart of the North Woods. It is a planetarium built by a gentleman named Frank Kovac Jr. in a rural Monaco off of Highway 8 near Rhinelander. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. We have Chris in Wausau. Chris, you're on Route 51 with Avi and Ron.
Hi, Glenn. Good morning, guys.
Oh, is this Chris Janssen?
It is, yes. I'm a space geek. I had to call.
Chris Janssen runs the planetarium at the Wausau West High School. And your background information, Ron and Avi. Chris, what's your question?
Well, I'm intrigued at how this guy built the mechanical part of it, the metallic panels. How did he project the star field? How did he know how much paint to use for particular bright stars or dim stars? What did he do with background images like galaxies? What did he do with movement? How did he build seating? I mean, it seems almost like an incredible standpoint just from the engineering, not even from the space outreach, building a program, marketing the program and things like that. Just his engineering. And I guess, has that been addressed or did you guys know exactly how he did this? Some of the details.
We talk about a lot of the details in the book. I'm trying to remember a lot of your questions, but I'll go through it as well as I can. First of all, the painting itself is actually done on styrofoam. He ribbed out this big sphere, and then he cut styrofoam panels that fit between the ribs. He had to treat them in a particular way so they would accept the paint. And as Ron was saying, he had to paint white on white. And he did this with his visual retention, with making little pencil dots. Some of the questions that you had, we had too. And we asked your colleague, Gene Creighton, who runs the planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, to actually come up and take a look at this thing for us, because Ron and I could tell it was an engineering marvel, but, we didn't. And we could tell the Big Dipper and Orion were right, but we couldn't really tell much beyond that. And Gene went up there one day with Ron and took a good look at it and told us he got it right. How he deal the one caveat to that is indeed what you were talking about, that there are stars of different colors and stars of different magnitudes. The colors he couldn't deal with very much. The magnitudes he could deal with by using a little bit more paint. As for indistinct objects, like say the Milky Way, he had to experiment a little bit with that, but he finally found a technique to be able to use to put it on. His first thought was just to aerosol a bunch where it ought to go, but that didn't work. He eventually settled on using a sponge. And you also talked about movement. And, of course, the objects that move the most in the sky relative to everything else are the planets. And he does have the planets on there. And what he has is he got little like Velcro furniture pads like you put on the bottom of a leg of a chair. And he periodically goes up and he moves them.
On that big ladder that's on the cover of her book.
Yes.
He's up on this ladder every week or two, 22 feet up, alone usually, making little adjustments. And he's still adjusting stars. He wants it to be perfect. Of course, it never will be. But every so often he notices something. And he'll go up and he'll erase what he painted and he'll paint over it. He's never going to be finished with this. But I can tell you that, and we've been to many planetariums, large and small, very sophisticated and otherwise, and Frank's show is quite convincing, and it's actually kind of awe-inspiring because this luminescent, it's an ultra-luminescent paint. It's about $500 an ounce. And it doesn't use ultraviolet light. It uses normal room light, and it just charges the paint up, and then it glows of its own accord when he turns out the lights. So he's doing, for one thing, he's doing the entire show in the dark himself because he doesn't want to interfere with the experience. And secondly, this paint it lasts a couple of hours, I think. So it's enough for a couple of shows, but. The way it all came together is quite remarkable, and the impression you have when you're looking up at his dome and at these stars is something quite three-dimensional.
One thing you have to understand, and it's not necessarily intuitive, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. When Frank got the paint, the instructions said, paint it on a white background. The reason being that if you charge it up in the light and then you turn out the lights, the white background becomes black. Right? Mm-hmm. And what's left is these dots of luminescent paint coming down at you. And the impression, as Ron said, is quite three-dimensional and looks very, very much like you're outside at night, which is exactly what Frank was aiming at.
Well, Chris Janssen, as somebody who operates a traditional planetarium with a projection device, what's your impression of this, of a guy hand-painting the stars and then rotating the dome?
Well, I guess I'm kind of laughing here a little bit because I think that maybe the only planetarium that can run for hours on like three AAA batteries. You know, like he all of the time went in up front and maintenance, you know, just amazing. He sounds almost like I haven't met him actually. I'd like to.
You ought to, yes.
Sounds like something on the Sistine Chapel, you know, painting for months and years at a time.
Well, it's funny you mention that.
Before the program, he fires up a nice flashlight or lighting system, a couple of batteries, charge up his projection system, and then the power could completely go out. He could keep giving his star talk.
Well, he'd still have to turn his motor. But
And Ron, that is the title of one of the chapters of your book, right? The Michelangelo of the North Woods?
The North Woods. Actually, that was... It wasn't a flip of a coin, but that was the other title we were thinking about for the book, and we had to settle as a chapter title.
Wow.
But, you know, Avi and I were just amazed at how many parallels there were between the way Frank painted the underside of his dome up on a ladder and scaffolding and the way Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel up on scaffolding. Obviously, they had different purposes and different skill sets, but... Physically and mechanically, the problems are amazingly similar, and the book covers that.
Chris, thanks so much for the phone call. You've never been to the Kovac Planetarium, correct?
No, but I've heard really good things. Girl Scout groups are up there quite often for campouts,
yep,
and things like that, and it's on my list.
You know, I've never been up there either. Why don't the two of us take a field trip?
Hey, that sounds good.
Go up
I like
there
that
together.
Idea.
That's Chris Janssen. He runs the planetarium at Wausau West High School. Chris, thanks so much for being with us. And thanks for your contribution to the show. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys.
And our guests again are Ron Legro and Avi Lank, whose book talks about this planetarium in the North Woods, a book called The Man Who Painted the Universe. I think we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, you will hear an interview with Frank Kovac, produced by National Public Radio's StoryCorps. But first, here's Paul Kantner, Grace Slick, and Jefferson Starship asking the musical question, have you seen the stars tonight?
Looked at all. Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Madison Gas and Electric, Al Johnson Swedish Restaurant, and Rittenhouse play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy, Stevens Point, with a focus on renewable energy system design and installation, including solar, wood, and deep energy retrofits to existing buildings. NorthwindRE.com.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, it's a story of Frank Kovac Jr., who as a child dreamed of flying to the moon, being an astronomer or an astrophysicist, and instead he moved from Chicago to the North Woods so he could see the stars, and he built from scratch his own working planetarium in Monaco off of Highway 8 near Rhinelander. Our guests today from our Milwaukee Bureau, veteran journalists Ron Legro and Avi Lank, authors of a new book, The Man Who Painted the Universe, The Story of a Planetarium in the Heart of the North Woods, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Ron and Avi, we just heard from Chris Janssen, who runs the planetarium here in Wausau. He gets a lot of satisfaction out of the children and adults who come in and get turned onto the stars, and I'm sure that Frank Kovac is the same way.
He really loves to present the stars to anybody who will listen. I think his favorite audiences, and he's got people of all age groups. He has senior center people coming over, people from disabled institutions. But he likes presenting to children. And he's gotten many, many handmade thank you notes from classrooms and individual kids. One kid that tugged on his shirt as he was leaving one time and said, "Mr. Kovac, I'm going to go to the planet Mars. I'm going to be the first man on Mars." And Frank gets a whole lot of pluses back from that. Plus, the kids are really smart. I mean, they ask him some very intelligent questions about cosmology and the universe.
Yes, kids have a lot of intelligence that we seem to lose as people as we grow older. Yeah. I've noticed that pretty frequently.
Yeah, they know what black holes are. They want to know, you know, is the sun going to burn out in 3 billion years or 5 billion years? I mean, they've pretty much got it figured out. And I often say when we're giving presentations, we're giving one tonight, by the way, right here in Whitefish Bay at the public library.
It's 6:30.
6:30 for all of you who are in the neighborhood. If you really wanted to grab kids, there are two things you can use to bring them in. And one's dinosaurs and the other is anything having to do with space. So really what you want to have is space dinosaurs, you know. And so maybe the meteor or the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs is the perfect astronomy show.
Well, before we continue with the conversation, I thought we should hear from Frank himself, Frank Kovac, unavailable for this program this morning because he is working his day job. But 4 years ago, he recorded this short interview for National Public Radio's StoryCorps. Here's Frank Kovac, Jr.
My name is Frank Kovac, and I built my own planetarium in my backyard. As a child, my dad had a small telescope, and I asked him if we could take it outside and look at the sky. And he said, "Sure, we'll go look at the moon." From that day forward, I wanted to be an astrophysicist, but I was always terrible at math, so I worked as a storeroom department clerk at the local paper mill. And then in the year 1995, I did a presentation at a local town hall. A group of Boy Scouts were to come out and look through the telescopes that I have. It turned out to be a cloudy night, and I thought, I'm going to fix that. I'm going to build a planetarium so we can never cloud out the stars. My neighbors, they were asking me, "How are you going to do it without any knowledge of engineering?" And I says, "Well, I just have an idea in my mind. I can envision this before I even built it." My planetarium is about 22 feet in diameter. The globe itself weighs approximately 4,000 pounds. And when I turn on the motor, it rotates around the audience, replicating the night sky. every single star is painted with glow-in-the-dark paint, about 5,000 dots, one dot at a time, and it took me about 5 months to get every single constellation you see from the Northern Hemisphere. My first show, I had just two people come, and I was a little nervous because I was a very shy person. I did terrible, stuttered too much, but nobody complained, and now I never tire of giving a show. I almost feel like it's always my first one. My dad passed away about the year I started to build the planetarium. There were days where I kind of wondered if I was even going to make this thing work, and you wonder, why am I doing this? And I felt that my dad was there watching over me. You know, I don't think I have the knowledge to build a planetarium, and here it is, the dream come true.
And Ron and Abby, we should probably mention that it is the Kovac Planetarium, but not the Frank Kovac Jr. Planetarium, the Frank Kovac Sr. Planetarium.
That's right. Frank's father was a handyman, a maintenance man in Chicago apartment buildings. He was a refugee from World War II, from Hungary through what used to be Yugoslavia. And, you know, he really did inspire Frank in all this. And I think one of the regrets of Frank's life is that his father did not live to see the planetarium open and being used to teach people the same kind of love for the stars that his father passed on to him.
Well, his father had to deal first with the Nazis and then with Tito's communist government, and you write that his whole family was persecuted.
There's a good section on that in the book, and in fact, a number of Frank's elders immigrated to the U.S. after the war, one after another. Frank's uncle, not just his father, came here first and managed to then help his Frank's dad come here. And ironically, Frank's uncle eventually resettled from, I believe it was the Toledo area, up to near Monaco in Crandon, and bought a small resort motel there. And he's still there. He and his wife, way up in their 80s, still running the motel. And
they
used
were
to come
very, very gracious to us in helping to write the
right.
Book.
Right, and his uncle used to come over and sort of supervise Frank from time to time. Although his wife was a little concerned that he was going to climb up that ladder and start doing the work himself.
Well, Frank,
but
senior,
really interesting sort of nuclear family, and he's got a sister living up in Monaco now, and his mother is still in, and one of his brothers still live in Chicago.
Well, Frank Sr. couldn't speak English for a long time, and that's had a very strong work ethic. That's something to think about, I think, with the current immigration debate.
Well, you know, it certainly does say that you bring a lot of talent into the country when you have people come into it. His mother, we should say, by the way, was a farm girl from Kansas. So it's half his family is immigrant and half his family is been in the United States for a while.
One thing that struck me when we were researching the book was that Frank's dad would take the kids and his wife on camping trips and. That was Frank's first taste of the real night sky. You know, from a city like Chicago or Milwaukee, you're lucky if you can see a few tens of stars at night, even on a perfect night, because of all the light pollution.
Right.
But, you know, Frank's dad would take him up into northern Wisconsin, and he'd say, this is just – and they would camp out and lay in the grass and look up at the sky, and Frank's dad would say, this is the old country. This is what it was like in the old country back in Europe when you did have rural areas and dark skies. And they brought that culture with them, which adds to our culture and makes us a more well-rounded place.
You know, this part of the story, gentlemen, really speaks to me personally. I grew up in the Chicago area. My grandparents, great-grandparents actually on my mother's side were Bohemian. Belsky was the name. They immigrated to the Pilsen neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, mm-hmm. and couldn't speak English for a while. In fact, they still retained a lot of that culture, and I remember that growing up. But my father, who was an engineer working in Chicago, would always take us on camping trips up to Presque Isle. And I remember going out on those fishing at night on a lake in Presque Isle, Oxbow Lake, and seeing all the stars up above. And I always swore that if I could, I would move up here. And I ended up doing that in 1993. So Frank's story struck a lot of chords with me personally, and I imagine it strikes chords with a lot of people who moved here from the big city to live in northern Wisconsin.
Frank's move was extremely deliberate up there. He when he got out of high school, he, as we said, he went to work in a machine shop for a couple of years, and he was living at home, so he was doing pretty well financially. And he and one of his younger brothers, I'm trying to remember what car, it was a fairly sporty kind of car they took, and they drove up to Rhinelander, and they there's this 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid, he's knocking on the doors of real estate agents saying, "I want to buy land up here." I mean, he knew it then, and that's, you know, and the whole thing was planned out. That's why he got himself assigned to Sawyer. He used to come down to Monaco on the when he got leave, and he was able to buy the land fairly inexpensively because they, you know, all the real estate people up there apparently figured, well, assuming this kid's for real, he obviously wants lakefront property. And he said, "No, I don't want lakefront property. All I want is where I can see the stars." And they essentially sold him old hunting camps on swampland, and it worked out real well for him.
And he ended up building the planetarium on that land, correct?
That's correct.
And used some of the trees for temporary staking. And he climbed those trees himself and skinned them and brought them down. We have pictures of Frank climbing trees. He's quite a scamperer up in the, you know, he could have been Tarzan in another lifetime, I think. By the way, Glenn, what you say about moving on up into the woods, one chapter of the book kind of talks about the culture of northern Wisconsin. And you know, I grew up in not too far from where this planetarium is myself.
You grew up in Antico, right.
Right. And it was wonderful being a kid up there then, in the 50s and the 60s, but people sort of underestimate small-town living and rural living in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And, I mean, we had a terrific high school. We had all sorts of recreational opportunities. Yeah, there were smart people, you know, hardworking, many of them blue-collar, but smart people who enjoyed life, enjoyed the outdoors, and still do. And I think that this is a good example of that, is that you can – it's easier to be a big city kid who moves into the woods than – or maybe it's easier the other way around. But I think people assume the opportunities aren't there for them if they've lived all their lives in big cities.
And well,
I think
exactly. That's starting to change. And you think you can't possibly make a living up north? And what you don't realize, of course, is that the cost of living is so much less than if you're living in a big city and commuting and having to park downtown. The educational opportunities up north in many of our communities, Wausau especially, we just, you know, talked to Chris Janssen, who teaches at Wausau West High School, phenomenal educational opportunities.
I must say, though, that one of those educational opportunities almost caused a problem for us. We had a very nice presentation a couple of months ago at the Rhinelander Public Library. It was wonderful. And when they found out Ron had been a Red Robin football player for Antigo High School, it almost caused some problems, but they decided to cut him a little bit of
Well, I wasn't a player, Abby. I'm just a fan. But you're absolutely right. But there is another side to this too, Glenn, which is that what you say about the cost of living in the book, we kind of look into this a little bit. A lot of these things are also narrowing. Small town life is becoming much more like big city life, whether it's related to crime, wages, wage scales, unemployment. So it's a big mix. We're a very homogenous country in many respects, and people still kind of – and there was a great study done by a University of Wisconsin sociologist a few years ago that talked about how people perceive each other up north looking south and vice versa.
Catherine Kramer is her name.
Yeah, she did a terrific study. And people divide themselves based more on geography and the size of their communities than they do in many other respects, whether it's financial, racial, or what have you. And really, when we drive around, and as reporters, we've been all over this state for decades covering all sorts of places, big and small. And I think what you see is that there's a lot more that we share than there is that divides us.
Would it have even been possible for Frank Kovac to build his homemade planetarium if he was living in Chicago or living in the Chicago suburbs? And he had no blueprints. He had no experience. How did he even get the building permits in Monaco?
He didn't, but that's okay. It turns out, as I was saying, he went up and he started to acquire this land almost at a random location. And if for those of your listeners who are familiar with the geography, you'll have to bear with me a minute. The town of Monaco is the last township that you're in before you cross from Oneida into Forest County. It's the easternmost township in Oneida County. And when Frank decided he wanted to build this thing, he went and he found the people on the right authorities in the town of Monaco and said, "Do I need any permissions?" And they said, not as far as we're concerned. Go talk to the people in Rhinelander at the Oneida County Courthouse, which he did. And they said, well, are you building this on a lake? And he said, no. And they said, well, then talk to the town. So it turns out that because of this sort of interesting bureaucratic catch-22, he didn't need any permits for what he was doing. We are told that if the land he had bought had been 5 miles further east – in Forest County, the situation would have been decidedly different and he would have needed lots and lots of permits. The only time that he got involved with needing to get paperwork approved by a government agency was when the thing was pretty much all done and he decided he was going to run it as a business. And it should be pointed out, by the way, that this is a business. It is not a nonprofit organization. Frank pays property taxes on the planetarium, if you can believe that. And taxes on whatever profits he's able to make. But in terms of needing government permission to do that, to open up as a business that serves the public, he needed to get permits from the state. He charges sales tax on souvenirs and things.
Right.
And that took him a long time because then he had to get an engineer to say it was okay. He had to prove he had a bathroom and handicapped access and all that.
That's how we know that it's safe.
We know it's safe, but you know he had to go find an engineer to come and take a look at it to help him fill out the state paperwork after he'd done it.
And because
the local authorities didn't really care. They didn't want drawings or anything like that.
And Frank has no employees. He cleans those bathrooms by himself. He does everything by himself.
That's right.
We ask him if he had ever thought to take on an apprentice, mentor his successor, or just have part-time help. And he has thought of it, but I think he identifies so closely with this edifice, this project, that it's almost like family, you know, and I think giving it away. We also ask in the book if, you know, he had investigated attaining not-for-profit status because that way he would save a lot of money. And he could still have his planetarium. And he really is not that interested in more paperwork. He just wants to run the place. And even if it's not in his own financial interest to do it the way he's doing it, it's simple, and he likes it that way.
We got to take a quick break, gentlemen. Ron Legro and Abby Lank, authors of the new book, The Man Who Painted the Universe, The Story of a Planetarium in the Heart of the North Woods. Here's John Lennon.
Across the universe, me under like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. Back in the day, oh, nothing's gonna change.
Thank you to the businesses who help support WPR programs, including Alvarado Real Estate Group, Festival Choir of Madison, and Northern Sky Theater. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, where programs for all ages amplify birds and art themes, now through November 29th, with opportunities to participate in workshops by visiting artists. LYWAM.org.
The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew, though I dream in vain. In my heart it will remain, my my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
As we listen to Hoagy Carmichael's original recording of his classic composition Stardust today on Route 51, we've been talking about stardust and moonbeams and planets and galaxies and Frank Kovac Jr., the man who built a working planetarium from scratch in the North Woods. Our guests, Ron Legro and Avi Lank, authors of the new book, The Man Who Painted the Universe, The Story of a Planetarium in the Heart of the North Woods. Gentlemen, you've got a chapter in the book entitled Hodags and Ponotoski, in which you describe the strange culture of northern Wisconsin, its giant statues of hodags and muskies and the giant loon in Mercer, and now a giant homemade planetarium.
Yeah, it, you know, especially perhaps for me, because I didn't grow up around here, the culture of the North Woods is fascinating and wonderful, and I find it really comforting to understand that I've decided to live in a state that supports that kind of a culture.
You quote this song by a group called the Berrymans.
Lou and Peter Berryman.
Home of the Kringle and Panfishes. If you don't like them, there's always cheese sandwiches. And for dessert, we have cranberry cake.
Once you find out we are known for our skipping and jumping and trolling and Christmas tree snipping, you'll probably decide that we're really not flipping, but all of the loons aren't out on the lake.
Oh, hey, look at that. There's a fish on a hat. Oh, we'd like to treat everyone here to a cow souvenir. There's a loon, there's a deer, there's a guy with a beer. There's the moon in the top of the tree, and it's still made of cheese. Wisconsin is proud of its wide open spaces, its barrels of beer and its butter in cases, its 20-foot mooses with fiberglass faces, and the biggest cows in the U.S. of A.
The beauty encourages
this is it.
Urges when artistic passion and nature converges, and out of the studio soon it emerges, the world's biggest muskie of paper mache.
Oh, hey, look at that.
Well, gentlemen, all the loons aren't out on the lake, and Frank Kovac's neighbors talked about his planetarium as Frank's sanitarium.
They also thought perhaps it was an alien starship come down. I would also like to say, you know, that there's a lot of intellectual life all over the state, and we will actually be participating in the Wisconsin Book Fair on Saturday in Madison as well, if anybody's interested in this, and they're going to be down in that area. We'll be giving a presentation at 10 o'clock at the Discovery Center on at the end of University Avenue there. And there's a lot of folks coming down from the northern part of the state for that as well.
They picked our book because of its science components and made us promise that we would try to be nerdy when we talk to the audience.
Which isn't too hard for us.
What does it say about all of us, about the potential in all of us, Frank Kovac's story, that here is this guy from Chicago, moved to the North Woods, and he had a dream and he followed it and he wouldn't let it die regardless of the naysayers? And is there that kind of potential in a lot of us that we just don't realize?
I think there is. I think we believe that. It's aspirational as a matter of human nature that you want to do something special and succeed and be remembered for doing something out of the ordinary. And many people do and don't even realize it. You know, the people that have just worked really hard to do regular jobs that really help other people. It's hard to recognize and see that. A giant 22-foot globe is easier to see. The difference between us and those people that we aspire to be like, including Frank Kovac, is that they managed to somehow do it. And I think what people forget, and the book covers this, is that when you decide to go down that path and stick to it no matter what, you have to make sacrifices. Frank has had to make sacrifices in his life and choices, and a lot of people aren't willing to make those choices. It's just the luck. It's not the luck of the draw and how lucky you were, and you know, it's not your skill set. It's what you choose to do with your life, and some of us choose to do other things for good reasons.
Ron Legro, Avi Lank, we are out of time. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks.
For a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. fantabulous night to make romance need the cover of October skies.
We want to thank today's guests, Ron Allegro and Abby Lank, authors of The Man Who Painted the Universe, The Story of a Planetarium in the Heart of the North Woods, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. You can purchase a copy on their website, wisconsinhistory.org. You can find out more about Frank Kovac Jr. and his planetarium at kovacplanetarium.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Dean Kallenbach, and our on-air producers, Jane Ritger and Lori Frazier. Thanks to the folks in our Milwaukee Bureau, including engineer Scott Myers, for making this show possible. Thanks to National Public Radio's StoryCorps. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Linda Ronstadt, Cliff Edwards as Jiminy Cricket, Paul Kantner and Jefferson Starship, Frank Sinatra, The Beatles, Hoagy Carmichael, and Van Morrison. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.